As you became more and more aware of your conscious memory of your previous existence as a horse, talk about what you started to picture and how you started to see the countryside and how you were able to sort of pinpoint that you could even get to like this region of England where you were once previously a horse.
It all started in 2003. And it was one of those things that seems like it was just by chance, but, you know, looking at the events after they happened, it's almost like it was something that was dropped in my path, something for me to pick up on, you might say. I can't just by chance came across a page on the Internet about a horse named Goliath. He'd been the Guinness Book of World Records world's tallest horse, a Shire, I think it was 19.2 hands high, weighing over 3,000 pounds, who had died in 2001. And he had lived at a place called the Northcote Heavy Horse Center. Before that, he had worked for a brewery. He'd been put to work at the age of two because he was because of his size. They didn't know his age at the time, and it ruined his joints. So he had arthritis in all of his joints. So he had to live at the horse center because they were the only ones who could care for him. And I just had a feeling that, and it was, I wish I could go and say more about it, but it was just a feeling that I should contact these people. So I started corresponding with Keith Sanders, who was the founder of the center. And we've corresponded ever since. It's been 6 years now. And that finally, about two years ago, he asked me to come over and visit. So I wasn't able to scrape the money together until this year, but I finally was able to get over there. But it really just started with a feeling. I very seldom come out to people about being a horse, but I just had a feeling, again, that if I did to him, that it would be all right. And it was.
So you had longed to go and actually put your feet into your native soil. How did that go?
Exactly. It did feel literally like going home. And going over there, once I got over there, the place did have a feeling of familiarity as soon as I landed, like, oh, this is my place. But it's just the architecture, especially the older homes and things, they had a what I guess I would call a type familiarity, that it was like, you know, the things that I had seen before, and just the way buildings are laid out, and the way the land is arrayed, and also even the way sunrises and sunsets look, because the lighting is different in England than it is here in Alaska because of the latitude. It reminded me of images that I, you know, half saw growing up, you know, especially around Christmas time, whenever I would see Victorian images of England as part of Christmas decorations or celebrations, I would see fleeting glimpses of things like that, and it clicked perfectly with what I saw when I was actually over there this year.
Right. And so when you were over there, and you were approaching that part of the country, did you feel maybe like how I might feel when I'm flying back in from Europe or something like that into the United States? I don't, it's my tribe, you know, I feel like I'm once more amongst my people. And is that what it's like for you, the closer you got to it?
Exactly. I was just about to say my people. That's exactly how I felt. I mean, those are the people who created my breed and our temperament. Thing is, most horse breeds reflect the temperaments of the people who breed them. Like, for example, the Scottish horse, you know, the Clydesdale is from Scotland, and they have a brisk, lively temperament that reflects that of the Scottish people. Whereas the Shire horse has a more quiet, reserved temperament, which reflects that of the English people, particularly the rural folk. And when I went over there, the personalities of the people I met, especially at the horse center and other horse folk over there who I ran into while I was over there, meshed perfectly with what I expected.
Okay. And so did you talk with the other horses? Did they recognize you as one of their own, kind of a prodigal horse returneth?
Two of them did. The Shires did not, because all of them, when I was over there in August, were eaten up with mange on their lower legs and feet. They were itching like crazy. I mean, they were stomping and screwing their hooves on the ground, and they gave them injections to kill the mites and then later the eggs. But the medication itself, also while it's acting, causes even more intense itching. When I would help them out with their public programs where the people could meet the horses, several of them would drop to the ground in the arena and start biting at their hooves just because it was itching so much. But there were two horses who did recognize me. Neither of them were drafts, though. One of them was a quarter horse named Buster, who belongs to Tarina Bolam. She's the manager of the center now, she's in charge of the horses. And it happened on the night, the first night I was there, when I they had set up a little trailer, what the British, the English call a caravan, for me to stay in while I was over there. And one night I had to get up and go to the bathroom, so I walked by the restrooms. They have their public restrooms that are part of this building that these two stalls are in, that these two horses live in. As I walked by them, the Buster the quarter horse, you know, he had sniffed me before. I'd met him, you know, earlier that day when I came in, but because it was quieter and there weren't people around, he was able to, you know, give his full attention to me. And he suddenly started sniffing me up and down over and over again, and his eyes got wide, and I knew that familiar look that meant he recognized me as a fellow horse. He started trembling again, you know, as if he had seen a ghost. And then he walked over, you know, still shaking, to the edge of the stall, got the attention of a black Frisian horse named Dante, who's his stablemate, and with a head gesture, you know, told Dante about me. And Dante, who had also been friendly with me the day before, he started sniffing me intently like that, and then he raised his head up, suddenly realizing that I was another horse, that I was a horse who had to be put in his place as part of that herd, and he lunged at my face with his teeth, and at that point, just instantly, I just whacked him across the face as hard as I could with my arm. You know, I had to, in other words, once a horse allows himself to be dominated, it's extremely difficult for him to regain respect within the herd hierarchy. So I had to establish my boundaries with him right there.
Kind of like being in prison.
Very much so, you might say, yes.
You had to whack somebody with a cafeteria tray before before things got out of hand. Mm-hmm. So are all horses like that? I mean, when you are show ponies different, are, you know, race horses different? When you see them or you get a vibe from them, would it be true to say that race horses are more arrogant and spoiled?
Yes, different breeds and horses who do different jobs do tend to have different temperaments. Like, for example, ponies are very, what the British would call, cheeky and playful. You know, sometimes they don't want to, you know, they're rather hard to get down to their work. Race horses do, you know, especially the ones that are the superstars of that field, they can be arrogant. They do tend to regard humans as hired, you know, as their maidservant, so to speak. You know, in other words, they have a superior air about them, as the British would say. And draft horses tend to be more, you know, tend to be quieter, and they tend to be more personable with human beings and with other horses. I mean, when we meet each other, we do, it's not always a confrontation like that. And in some breeds, it tends to be more often, but in many cases, it's just like, especially with drafts, especially if a more cautious horse will approach a lower ranking herd member, it can be a very very peaceful meeting between the two.